Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Margaret Bashar. Margaret Bashar's first chapbook, Barefoot and Listening, was released on Tilt Press. Her second chapbook, Letters from Room 27 of the Grand Midway Hotel, is forthcoming from Blood Pudding Press. Her poetry has appeared in the anthology Time You Let Me In, 25 Poets Under 25, edited by Naomi Shihab Nye. She co-hosts the poetry cabaret The Typewriter Girls with Crystal Hoffman and edits Hyacinth Girl Press, a feminist poetry chapbook press of science and spirituality. Currently, she is also editing an anthology titled Make It So, Poems Inspired by Star Trek, The Next Generation. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Renee.
Thanks for being here today. Well,
thank you for having me.
Do you want to start us off with some poems?
Sure. This one's titled, The Girl Who Ate the Earth and All Her Ancestors. She imagines sometimes it's aphasia, when she cannot understand what is being said, when she feels as though her head has been cut into very small pieces, that she is a stone skipped across the water. She did it suddenly one night, forgot all the words she had ever known for fire, and named it animal instead, watched it creep and jump, watched it devour as she dug her hands into the wet ground, ran her fingers over her mouth, and tried to guess the age of the earth, how many lives were on her tongue. She imagined what it would mean to never sleep again, to stop cutting the land down into perfect squares of green and brown and gray, and her throat was full of it. She shoved her hands into the earth and reached back to the first creature who propped herself up on 2 feet and used her wide mouth for language. Sometimes she imagines she will have 8 fat children, carry them on her back, and teach them to eat the earth until it is time for them to eat her instead. She ate her grandfather first. He tasted like swamp mud, got caught in her teeth. He was not a good man, and it was easy. Next, the great aunts for whom she had been named, their small mouths pressed to hers for an instant. She chewed her great-grandmother down to the bones and swallowed in one mouthful all her father's blood relatives she would never meet. She took in one bite her grandmother's tiny hands, knee highs, orthopedic shoes, and racism. She felt the knitting needles her grandfather had requested on his deathbed catch in her throat. She swallowed harder. But her father, she ate him last. His pale legs, the faint smell of tobacco buried deep in his sweater where he thought she would not find it, his memories of standing in a crib and crying alone, of leaping from a helicopter into elephant grass and not knowing how far down it was that he would fall. This next poem is titled Wasichu. Wasichu is a Lakota word for people of non-Indigenous descent, usually white people, and it's very close to the term in their language that also means taking the fat and is used as sort of a pun on non-natives who rob Indigenous people and their land of the resources. She is not a woman born from the desert, did not fall from the belly of the coyote, burst from the eagle's nest. She does not grow corn on her body. They had to pry her from her mother, clamp her head with forceps, and pull her into this lifetime. She knows there is a thread that ties her back to when she lived in Hell's Creek, when she first stomped up on land. And if she can pull that thread taut, she will be able to hear all the words she has ever said. There's a stone in her throat. She coughs it up some nights and holds it in her hands, reads a new language on it. But in the morning, she has always swallowed it again, and she cannot remember why. She thinks she might bleed it out, that she might turn to the sun one day and it won't burn her eyes, won't turn her the color of a clean pig. She wants to be the right girl for this, wants to dance when she hasn't slept all night, wants to make up for the 25 years she has missed and breathe in something clean. But she cannot hold in her hands the idea of nothing. She swears she would look to her own ancestry. If only her father had not been adopted, if only her uncle had not beaten her father, then his wife, then his daughter. If only her mother's father had not done the same. I am sick and afraid to be sick. What is there to be learned from men like these? She swears she will not be the girl who buys acrylic blue beads, goes to dream catcher workshops. But still, she finds herself running the tips of her fingers along rabbit pelts in the craft store. Still, she worries she is made of plastic, that the good grandfather will die, and it will be all her fault, that his jaw will click shut, that he will suck his lips into his mouth, and there will be nothing for it. This next poem is titled A Basic Guide to Science. 1. On this planet, it is true that there is no such thing as empty space. Just places where the stuff we are is thicker than what is in front of us. 2. 46 million years ago, the oldest whale's legs disengaged from its pelvis. Its neck went rigid. Its ankles double-spooled. It swam like a Russian mole. 3. Cup your left hand. Spoon into it dirt, seed, your choice of fertilizer. Hold your hand in the light for approximately 9 hours a day. Water your soil regularly. Measure what grows. Feel the roots push between your fingers. 4. If we are all Brahman's dream, who needs M-theory anyway? Of what use is a table that you will never memorize, that never stops growing?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Margaret Bashar, reading from her work. Something that strikes me immediately about your poetry is this interest in the mythological. Can you talk about that?
Well, I guess growing up, I was always a kid who I wasn't really interested in a lot of like the books and literature that were written for girls my age. I was like in the second grade, I was reading like the Trilogy of the Rings, and my parents had this old like dictionary of mythological terms, and I literally would just like sit there and read like entry by entry through the whole dictionary. And so I guess the fantastical and the mythological and the spiritual has always kind of captivated my imagination. And I mean, I remember when I was very small, it just kind of seemed natural to me that we were all going to be reincarnated. It like just it was something that sort of seemed inherent inside me that like, oh, this just makes sense. I was a cat before, and then like I'm going to eventually be a tree or something else. And I was actually quite disappointed when I was told by, I believe, somebody at the Sunday school that I attended that this was not, in fact, the case. I was very upset by that. But I think that also mythology kind of – mythology has a way of saying, in the same way that we often use like science fiction, which is another genre that I'm very interested in, mythology and fantasy and science fiction – all have a way of saying that which cannot be said plainly. I think it was Isaac Asimov, actually, who talked about science fiction in that way, about how it, whenever you're trying to say something that's controversial or you're trying to say something that's difficult for people to hear or something that if you tell them directly they might initially reject, when you're able instead to use mythology or use fantasy or use science fiction, a person can actually be more receptive to that sort of, I don't want to say roundabout, but a different way of presenting something. Because we tend to be very attached, I think, to the way that we see things in what we think is, quote, as the real world. But if we can see something as a metaphor or as an allegory, sometimes we're more able to accept something that's different from how we perceive the world.
I noticed that a lot in the girl who ate the earth and all her ancestors. It seemed like you were using that very sort of fable like structure and language as a framework for this scene that we wind up in, which sounds like, you know, a war zone. That's an interesting approach.
The funny thing is, I don't usually, you wouldn't know it from the poems I just read, but I don't normally write about my family. That's not something that, I mean, I have a small child. He's almost six. And I'm not somebody who usually writes about family. I'm not sure why that is. But it's not something that I usually am drawn to write about. And so it's only recently that I've been more writing about family and the experience of my family. I guess it's because perhaps, I don't know, maybe growing up, I was like, well, you know, everyone's got a family, you know, I'm going to write about like crazy stuff. And then I think that was like, I grow and mature. I realize that there's kind of a mythology within a family in a way, if that makes sense, that each family sort of has their own mythology. And so instead of seeing those two things as separate, I'm starting to see them more as things that really are inherently together. And I think also, you know, when you're like, you know, 9, 10, 13, 14, however old, you know, you don't know all of like the crazy secrets of your family. But then, you know, as you get older, either you find it out accidentally or like you have that confessional moment with another member of your family. And so you start unraveling the mythology of your family. And that's actually, it's interesting because I've been looking at my work and I've realized that as I slowly unravel that mythology of my family, I'm more able to write about, and I'm more able to have a deeper understanding of each of the members of my family. And so even when there's something that maybe somebody wasn't comfortable telling me about 5 years ago or 10 years ago, now it's actually a form of healing, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that poem was actually like my first big step towards that sort of understanding of the mythology surrounding my family.
Okay. Can you read us some more?
Sure. This one is titled Meditation on Ichthyosaurus. 1. You are the stuff I breathe in. You who sucked your young back into your belly. You who opened your mouth wide. I run and run through the space we flattened, that we long ago made new with our hands and the new hands that they made. I am you in this one moment. Oh, you, the one who gives me koans to keep in my palms, to slip under my tongue, to let fall out onto my pillow. We are both small breaths of this galaxy waiting to be released. When I think of this galaxy, of every galaxy beyond it, that is when I think of you. That is when I see myself in Holes Maiden with my neck arched back, my body convulsing. That is when I know the moment of my death and every moment of death you and I have known together. I have eaten you in every lifetime. And yes, you have devoured me. And now I stand here and we are both bone and we are each monsters the other could not quite imagine. I named you because I couldn't not. I named you because that is the way it has always been, the naming of things. Fish lizard, you are the thing I name when I cannot open my mouth. We will stomp up onto the land. We will grow legs and we will lose them again. We will make our mouths into caverns and then into shallow bowls and into caverns again. Our tongues will be gnawed from our mouths and replaced by the very parasites that ate them. Our tongues will be part of us and then not, and then they will be again. Our fingers will fuse and split. We will hold up the sky with our limbs longer than all the lines that etch themselves across our faces, longer than any ice age or stem of any Jurassic plant that once floated across the floor of the ocean, that followed us home with its petals always reaching for our legs, our fins, our opened eyes. 2. I lived in a dead coal mining town for one season. Slept with ghosts and ran barefoot, naked into the night. Now everyone I meet knows someone there. A man I slept with 4 years ago told me this was where his girlfriend had grown up when we lay shivering in a room in the town's haunted hotel. He told me this, and then I thought of you, fish lizard, and I did not know it was you I was thinking of. I did not know you then. Your awful beauty, your mouth wider and larger than any hole that could have opened in my stomach at that moment. Your mouth darker than my eyes turned as I smiled and I kissed his hip. Everyone I meet these days is from the same dead coal mining town, the town where I know I saw you one evening, the town where I let a demon take my hand and a man I didn't know tie me up, and sometimes I think he must have been you, fish lizard, my old friend. Where are you now? Are you there, hands reaching into the night? Are you there and you are at the bar and I am dancing on it and I'm naked and you are the one whose beer I kicked over and you are always looking away from me? And I will never stop looking toward you, toward the thing I have named. We have never been so far from each other as we are now. Me with my hands all in the air, you with one body in Pennsylvania's belly, and the other in the same town as everyone else. Who hasn't waded through this sulfur creek? Who hasn't stumbled into this gas station at 3 a.m., half blind with potato vodka and exhaustion? Who hasn't danced naked with me and had to lie to their fiancé about it the next day? Who hasn't lain on their back with the whole planet spinning beneath them and forgotten what their name was this time around? We are both in this town because now everyone is in this town, like we both lived in Holzmaden, like we both swallow the water we swim in. It will take 200 billion years for me to circumambulate this mountain. I knew you in Germany, and I know you here in Pennsylvania with my mouth open. Now we can both speak. Now we both have tongues. We have tongues and mouths shaped like fake hearts. You are looking at my body beneath glass somewhere, too. You are somewhere else, and you, too, are thinking of all of these things. We are made of each other. And one day, I burned you to ashes, and I did not know it. And one day, you ate me, and you did not know it either.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Margaret Bashar. I'm interested in the recurring references to science. Mm-hmm. In your poems, you have the basic guide to science, and then you have this meditation on ichthyosaurus. Is that it?
Yes, ichthyosaurus. Well, I guess in addition to me, I guess it kind of goes along with being kind of like a science fiction fantasy geek. Those people are also, you know, we're very much into science as well, you know. And it's kind of funny because a lot of the people who I know who are into science fiction, into fantasy are, you know, they're very science-oriented people, and they're not like spiritual people necessarily. It kind of seems to me very often like you get people who it's like kind of like a one or the other sort of thing a lot of the time. And I'm somebody who's always been absolutely fascinated by science. Like, I'm absolutely fascinated in like the vastness of the universe. Like, I know that seems like such kind of like, it's like, yes, silly poet, you are into the vastness of the universe. But like, I spent this period of time a few months ago where like I was on the computer, or I was like reading books, and I was just like trying to contemplate and understand the enormity of the universe. And it was actually driving my husband a little crazy because he'd be like, what are you doing? I'd be like, I'm trying to figure out how enormous the universe is and understand it. And I literally, I would sit there and I would like look at like, okay, here's a picture of the Earth, and here's a picture of the sun in comparison to the Earth, and here's a picture of this sun in comparison to our sun. And then I went through like this whole sequence of trying to like understand and conceptualize like how tiny we are, but also how vast we are as beings. And I think that this understanding, there's this documentary I watched about Stephen Hawking, and he talked about the science of the very small and the science of the very large, and trying to bring these two things together. And I kind of feel like that's something that I'm trying to do in my poetry in a way, is bring together this like science of the very small and the science of like the very large and enormous, and at the same time also say like, yes, we have science, we have this level of understanding about physics and biology and chemistry and evolution, but that doesn't mean that we can't also see mystery in the world, and that doesn't mean that we can't also believe in our own mythology. And I mean, yes, we see these things that are so much bigger than we are in other galaxies. Like, the sheer like number of galaxies is astonishing in the universe. And I guess I don't see this like the wonder of that as being separate from spirituality. Like, and you see those two things clashing all the time, science and spirituality. There's clash over and over and over again.
I think you see them too that occurring side by side in your poetry, but they also occur in these narratives that sound very personal, not necessarily, you know, biographical, but mm-hmm. you're talking about these really grandiose ideas, but your poetry doesn't sound like a lecture from, you know, Stephen Hawking or something. It sounds like storytelling.
Yeah, I hope that is how I like telling. I guess it's the other thing, I like telling stories. I was always a kid who actually was kind of obnoxious, and now my son does this, so it's kind of a I guess I'm getting payback from the universe. I would read a book or I would see a movie and I'd be like, I have to tell somebody that story. But because I was five, like my storytelling abilities were really poor. And so I'd be like, so there was this guy and he had blue hair and he went to a river and he almost drowned, but he caught a really big fish. And that's not the plot of the movie at all. It's just like the things that I picked out from it. But I don't know, I've always been interested in storytelling and I see that in my son as well. And it's a really nice thing to see because he loves storytelling and he loves but at the same time, I just bought him an Atlas of the Universe because he wanted it, not because I'm pushing my interests on him, mind you. And I think also that storytelling, it's a really ancient art form. It's the way that we've passed down knowledge as a people, like long before we had, you know, the written word that was accessible to as large of a portion of humanity as it is now. We had, you know, we had oral traditions and we had storytelling that, you know, kind of evolved also from person to person. Each storyteller, I mean, invariably is going to, like, you know, there's going to be a slight shift in that story, even just in like the way perhaps that the person tells that story.
So do you see your poetry as participating in that lineage?
Would it be arrogant if I said that I want to participate in that lineage?
I think that's a fine goal. Can you read us some more?
Sure. This poem is titled Glossolalia. Claire carries nothing in her pockets when she goes to visit the old hotel. Her hands are full of themselves. She visits when the last dog has limped home, when the last train has stopped in the graveyard, when the last mayfly nymph has died, when the last umbrella has been closed. She goes there to speak the secret names of her gods, to swallow the taste of the day. When she is there, she opens her mouth and birds fly from her throat, and she is not as dumbfounded as she should be. It is never dark in the hotel's halls like she remembers, but that darkness still births her, reborn with each time she utters her god's names, language thick on her tongue. There is something that reminds her of this place. It is the dead deer by the road. It is the crease on her knuckle. It is the smell of dust. It is the taste in her mouth, always sweet. She watches the girls who let Japanese beetles eat holes in their arms, and she would laugh if she didn't have scars on hers. There's a voodoo doll in this place for every night she's slept alone, smiling blue-lipped with her hands tucked between her thighs. She swallows morning glories until something bursts inside her, and she speaks suddenly in tongues, and she understands it all. Trichotillomania, which is actually a psychological condition where a person plucks all of the hair from their head and often ends up, like, eating it. It's a very interesting, slightly horrific condition. Claire is the hyacinth and the egg, still unbroken in this town that does not belong to her, with its bars and motorcycles on Main Street, with its one grocery store and the haunted hotel where she sleeps with dead monkeys and little girl ghosts. At night, she gets open-mouthed, sweet green pepper kisses from a man who could be her father, thick hands heavy on her shoulders. And in the morning, they never speak of it. When they first met, he would bring her hurricanes to hold in her palm, catch her in his teeth as she searched for the sun, face a naked flower bulb. He shot her once, and she carries a lump of lead in her chest to prove it. We'll show any boy who wants to see. He brought her here one hot summer afternoon, tied up her fingers, and carried her in his mouth. She is not certain when he spit her out. But now he leaves her with tonsil stones, their chalky stench in the crypts of her body, in her stomach, and he is in her periphery when she plucks hairs from her head, one at a time, and bites off the roots. She swears it's like sinking her teeth into raw meat. Because she does not know what is at the back of her head. She says she will know when her mouth is full and the water boils over. Filled with honey and apple seeds, she will become all at once with senses she never knew she had. She writes notes in black ink on the pads of her fingers, presses them onto pages of library books or handles of coffee shop mugs. Mouth open like the sun and pockets stuffed with cattails, her eyes are widened to the letters on her fingers, pinhead bruises on her thighs. She feels voices like an undertow, and there is a hand that uncurls inside her like a fern, stretches and cracks, reaches into her throat.
The poetry of Margaret Bashar. Thank you so much for being here, Margaret.
Well, thank you for having me, Renee.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody 91.3 WYEP.